A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, fellow time travelers. As always, terrific to have you with me as we travel together through space and time in search of understanding. Before we get started, I have to say thanks. I don't have to say thanks. I willingly offer up my gratitude to all the people who show their support for this podcast series by subscribing to my patreon.com site, because it's the financial support from there that enables Paul and I to do everything else that we do on here. So thank you to all of those who've already done so. If you're not a member and you'd like to join, please do go to patreon.com, search for me by name, fill in the form, tick the box, part with some cash, and become part of the family. And it is a family, it's a community of people who are in touch with one another. We're all like-minded, inquiring, curious types, fascinated by history and archaeology and current affairs. There's a weekly question and answer, there's weekly vodcasts, there's the all access to the podcasts. It'd be great to have you along. So that's enough of the advert, now it's time to strap ourselves into the time machine as we set off on the next stop on my love letter to the world. Recorder, microphone, action. Power, propaganda and purgatory. Barefoot and fasting. A blizzard raging all around him. For 3 days and three nights, wearing only a penitent's hair shirt, the Emperor stands outside the castle gates. The crown and the church go head to head. Excommunication, submission and absolution. A bitter clash for control of the strings of power, and a wound is opened that won't heal for centuries. Endeavouring to understand history in hopes of illuminating the future, I'm Neil Oliver and this is my love letter to the world.
Hi Neil, in the last episode we saw the battle lines being drawn up for what would fuel the coming crusades. Which moment in history are we at this week?
Well, Paul, this week our focus shifts somewhat, and instead of looking at the battle between different religions, we're examining an eternal fight within one of them. We're heading to the castle of Canossa in Italy, as two ruthlessly stubborn men are at each other's throats as church and state wrestle for power. We're in a place called Canossa, which is in northern Italy. And the characters involved are Henry IV, who is the Holy Roman Emperor, and he's up against Pope Gregory VII. And it's one of those fantastic, to me anyway, fascinating tussles between the secular world and the religious world that were always bumping heads, especially in the Middle Ages. The date, let's say the 28th of January 1077, okay, so we're in that first part of the second millennium AD. I love these stories. Remember when Bishop Ambrose went head-to-head with the emperor and brought him to heel? It's another of those. And I find that testy relationship that there was from the start, really, between the leader of the Christian faith and whoever was the earthly secular leader, kings, emperors, whatever, there's always conflict. There's always conflict between them, because you can imagine the kind of characters, you know, kings and emperors, they're born to it. You know, so they talk about entitlement. They're the sort of men that are born, and women, they're born believing that they've been put upon their thrones by an act of God. Those that are, that feel divinely inspired, you know, you talk about people like King Charles I in England, you know, he was absolute, and his father, James VI, absolutely convinced that they were there because God wanted them to be there. And then they come up against a character like a pope. And popes are similarly, whatever their faith might have been, they were ambitious men who wanted power, wanted control. And they also believe that they've got their position directly from God. So you've got the stages set at that point. If you get the two wrong sorts of characters that happen to be on the two thrones, you know, the throne of St. Peter's in the Vatican and the imperial throne or a king, you're always going to get trouble. And what happened between Henry IV, the emperor, and Gregory VII, the pope, in the 1070s, it goes down as some of the most significant moments in all of the Middle Ages. Right, it's a big deal, this one.
And is it because there's so much at stake, you know, power and wealth and all that?
Yeah, I think we see it even today. Really, people of a certain mindset are after power, and they're after control. They want power, and they want that power because they want to tell everyone else what to do. It's a psychology. I think it's practically an illness, where you want to control the behaviour and the lives of people you'll never meet. They want to cast the shadow of their hand as far as they possibly can, so that everyone, even people they'll never talk to, never know in life, they want to content themselves with the idea that all of the people are doing what they tell them to do. And we see it around us now. You know, you obviously, in the characters that have gravitated into the political realm, for example, especially those that take up senior office, prime ministers, chancellors of the exchequer, foreign secretaries, home secretaries, those characters. And then you've got the World Economic Forum, and you've got the World Health Organization, the United Nations, the European Union, the sort of people that drift into those, or they don't drift, they determinedly get in amongst those organisations, and then once they're in, they want to get to the top job. Those people are trouble. I'm telling you now, you know, this notion that they're in it because they want to make the world a better place, I don't buy it. Not from any of them. I think any of the ones that actually emerge as being minded to make the world a better place, I'm pretty sure they're the ones that get bumped off. I think they're the ones that get a bullet, to be quite honest. So power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's a cliche, but it's true. So you had these two characters. You've got Henry IV, Gregory VII. His real name, he's Pope Gregory VII. His real name's Hildebrand. Relevant or irrelevant, I don't know, but Hildebrand's a hero from German legend, a very powerful figure. So that was his given name. That was the name his mum gave him. And who knows, maybe that affected him. And quite unusually, really, among popes, people tended to remember and continued to refer to him by his name. So as well as calling him Pope Gregory, Hildebrand became a, you know, that was the brand. And I don't know whether it was because of the fact that Hildebrand, as a name, referred to somebody heroic and determined. So there was trouble between these two men right from the get-go, because Henry believed absolutely that he had the power to invest bishops and senior clergy in his empire. If the job became vacant, it was up to him to appoint the next bishop. That wasn't just his belief, that was a belief that was as old as Christianity. The kings and the emperors, they wanted to believe that appointing those roles was up to them. Not Pope. They didn't appoint the Pope, but everybody else with a religious job, with a religious job title, was going to be appointed. And Henry IV was as committed to that as anybody before him or anybody after. And he comes up against Gregory VII, who believes absolutely that it should be the Pope that does all this. You can see both sides. You can certainly see why the head of the church would believe that the senior roles in the church beneath him, that he would have the final say. So they're going to be in conflict. It starts to come to a head. They are bumping heads, but on the 24th of January 1076, Henry took the step of bringing a gathering of German bishops together at Worms, a city in Germany. It's not far from Frankfurt, I think. So he brings them together for a synod, which is a gathering. And he persuades them, however it's achieved, that they kind of abandon their loyalty to the Pope, these German bishops. And energised and inspired by that gain, Henry demands that Gregory abdicate, steps down from the role of Pope. Well, you can imagine. Gregory the VII takes umbrage at this. His response is to excommunicate Henry. Right, so to excommunicate literally means to put out of the community. He's out of the church. He's out from underneath the umbrella provided by God. And in the understanding of the time, and there are those who still believe it to this day, if you're excommunicated, you can't get into heaven. So your soul is eternally damned. So that was the biggest penalty, really. Well, short of death, but that wasn't really in the Pope's gift. But to be excommunicated in some ways was worse than death, because it meant that forever after your soul was damned. So he brings this down on Henry. Now, powerful people being powerful people, the way that that's responded to, you know, back in Germany and around Henry, his friends abandon him, they turn their backs on him, and his enemies start sharpening their knives, because, you know, the princes, the German princes that aren't emperor but fancy a crack at that job, there's blood in the water now. The German princes, not all of them, but enough of them, come together and they declare that if Henry's not back in the good books, if his excommunication isn't cancelled within a year, then they will disregard him as emperor. And furthermore, they will choose a new candidate. So the game is afoot now. You can't put yourself back in the mind of anyone, and you certainly can't put yourself back in the mind of Henry IV, but it's difficult to work out why he plays the game the way that he does. For one thing, although he's in trouble with the aristos around him, which is hardly surprising because that's a nest of vipers, but the people, his subjects, if you like, they're still on side. He retains popularity, right? So it may be the case that he thinks, right, the people will want me to be in a good place. The people who love me, they'll certainly want me to still be within the body of the Kirk. So it may have been in his calculated interest to take the path that he did, because he decides that he will go and seek forgiveness from Hildebrand, from Pope Gregory. Is it because he finally decides that he's in trouble with God? Is it truly the act of a penitent man? Or is he playing politics? Is he just making sure to keep his people on side by doing something that probably in the main they might approve of? Who knows? But the point is that he sets out to put himself in front of the Pope and seek forgiveness. Word reaches him. You have to wonder how word gets around in these, you know, in the 1070s, but he doesn't get an email, obviously, but word reaches him that the Pope is in Canossa. He's staying with Matilda of Tuscany. Matilda of Tuscany is a significant personage in her own right. She's got her own problems with Henry. And lo and behold, she's sucking up to the Pope. And Pope Gregory has taken the opportunity to be with her. So he's in her castle at Canossa. And Henry decides to go there. And it's not easy. He embarks with his wife, who's Bertha of Savoy, and their son, Conrad, who's just a child, and they set out with a retinue. 50 people, it's difficult to be sure, so they come from Germany, and they're going for, you know, they go to be with him to look for him in Canossa. And it was a difficult path that he had to walk, literally and metaphorically, because the German princes, some of them at least, decided to make it hard for him. And so, for example, the easiest route into northern Italy was barred for him. So he had to go the hard way, you know, over a considerable mountain pass in winter. Right? So there's snow and all the rest of it, snow and ice. And by some estimates, Henry himself and his wife and his child were in real physical danger as they made their way to Canossa. But eventually, they get there. So he arrives in Canossa and he turns up outside the gates. And it's January 1077. It's bleak. It's a storm. It's, you know, winter is raging. And he turns up, the lot of them turn up outside the gates at Canossa, and the gates are barred to them. So Henry, according to the stories, he's wearing, when he appears and goes down on his knees at the gates of the castle, he's wearing just a hair shirt. Right? So he's dressed, playing the part of the penitent. And the hair shirt's quite interesting, actually. The hair shirt was what all penitents traditionally wore. Certainly someone seeking forgiveness, but it's also deeper than that. If you go all the way back to into prehistory, like if you go back to, say, somewhere like Çatalhöyük in Turkey, which is an ancient prehistoric village where some of the very first farmers lived, right back at the switch from hunting to farming, Çatalhöyük was a big settlement of people all living together. A city really had come together. You might as well call it a city. And there's impressions in the clay floors and in some of the ceramics there from animal skins with hair. And for various reasons, archaeologists have suggested that it's possible that the people of Çatalhöyük, in their kind of cosmology, might have from time to time worn hair shirts or garments with animal hair, rough, uncomfortable, against the skin, because they might have been doing that in pursuit of a cleansing, a spiritual cleansing, you know, to get on the right side of whatever their understanding of reality was. So the idea of the hair shirt is old. Anyone who's seen, the Dan Brown movie, The Da Vinci Code, there's the mad monk that wears what he calls a cilice, which is that metal chain, like the top of a socks, is that suspender belt thing that he tightens around his thigh and the nails dig into his flesh and he bleeds in its agony. That's called a cilice. Well, the broader term cilice also takes in something like a hair shirt. It's anything that's worn deliberately to make you physically uncomfortable. And in the Christian tradition, it's what John the Baptist, if you read the Gospels, John the Baptist is described as wearing camel hair clothes or a robe or a wrapping made of camel hair. And it's further in the Christian tradition, there's the idea that he was wearing that as penitence. You know, you're punishing himself in an attempt to become a better person. So the hair shirt is a big deal that runs right through the story of humankind in search of enlightenment. It's always there. So Henry's got the hair shirt on. He's on his knees, and Gregory keeps him there on his knees, fasting, not eating, for 3 days. I'll read you from Gregory's own account, the Pope's own account. Once arrived, he, Henry, presented himself at the gate of the castle, barefoot and clad only in wretched woolen garments, beseeching up with tears to grant him absolution and forgiveness. This he continued to do for 3 days until all those about us were moved to compassion at his plight. Indeed, they marvelled at our hardness of heart. So, you know, people around the Pope are begging him to let Henry in because he's being such a good penitent. So the door's open. Henry comes in, he maybe gets to change out of his hair shirt, it's not quite clear, and he takes communion with Henry and with Matilda of Tuscany. So it must have been, no matter what, it must have been a bit of a humiliation for him, because there he is in face of two of his opponents and he has to suck it up. And he takes communion and that's it, he's back in the body of the church. And then the three of them and more of the entourage, they sit down for a dinner. And apparently at the dinner, Henry didn't eat a mouthful. He just sat digging his nails into the wood of the table because, you know, he's grimacing at the humiliation of it all. So this, arguably the most significant moment when a secular ruler, an emperor, was put in his place by a churchman, the Pope. This is the start of the investiture contest, so-called, as it's known, because Henry having taken up this position and Gregory having taken up this position, it continued on with other characters forever. It was always there in the background. But this moment when Henry goes on his knees and begs the forgiveness of the Pope and gets welcomed back into the church and takes communion at Canossa is regarded as one of the most significant moments in the whole of the Middle Ages. And it was never forgotten. The walk to Canossa, it's kind of fallen from common parlance now, but for the longest time, to walk to Canossa became something you said if somebody had had to, you know, had had to humiliate themselves really, or had to do something against their will in order to get something else they wanted. That was called, you know, oh, so-and-so had to walk to Canossa. It went into the common parlance at that point. Even, I mean, perhaps one of the most famous ones, when Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, goes to Berchtesgaden to see Hitler in 1938, you know, comes back with a piece of paper and all that. People at the time said, you know, that Chamberlain has taken the walk to Canossa because he was going there to see somebody that, a great rival, in pursuit of something that he wanted, and maybe didn't want to have to go to him, you know, the Muhammad had to go to the mountain, as it were, you know, Chamberlain had to go to Hitler, but that was walking to Canossa. And on the face of it, you know, if you just draw the line there, you think, oh, well, that's it. The Pope's, he's won the game. He's won the investiture contest. But oh, no. No sooner was it over, no sooner was Henry back in Germany than he was, you know, bumping heads with the Pope again, because he had, you know, no intention of surrendering his determination that he be the top dog. They just keep fighting. And, you know, Gregory excommunicates Henry again. it all happens again. And they go to war. There's a civil war, and Henry wins it. Henry's triumphant. He invades Rome, and Gregory has to flee, and Henry has him replaced with the so-called anti-pope, Clement III. He puts his own man in the top job, as a further snubbing of Hildebrand, Gregory the Seventh. But there you go. It is a significant moment in history, regarded by some as one of the most significant events in the whole of the Middle Ages. It reverberates down through history, because by the time you get to the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, Henry VIII and all that, Henry IV, that unruly, that turbulent emperor, he is exalted by some. He's held up by some as a kind of a poster boy of the Protestant. Sometimes they call him the first Protestant, because, you know, because obviously Protestantism was protesting about the Catholic Church and therefore the Pope. And when the Reformation got up and running, people looked back to the way that Henry IV had taken on Gregory the Seventh, and so they called him the first Protestant, and he became a poster boy of the Reformation. And people looked to Henry's example for guidance as to how they were to approach a tyrannical institution. And for that reason, you know, that's why it has such modern connotations, because the centralisation of power that's going on, be it in the European Union, be it in the World Economic Forum, you know, that centralising of power, anyone going up against it would be seen as taking their lead from Henry IV, who, when confronted with this figure trying to cast the shadow of his hand over the Christian world, went for him, and to some extent succeeded in the end in knocking him off his perch. So the consequences, the aftershocks, the reverberations of Henry IV's walk to Canossa to confront or to meet with Gregory the Seventh, it's a big deal.
The church was a lot more powerful then, wasn't it? I know it's still powerful today, but it was a lot more powerful then, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. There still is for many people, but at the time, when more people believed absolutely in the power of God, you know, the presence of God there, looking down on everyone, you know, the ultimate surveillance camera. So they believed in the power of the church and the power of bishops and the power of the Pope. These men, for the mass of the population, held in their hands everyone's eternal souls. You know, they had power over whether or not you got to heaven or whether you spent eternity in perdition and hell. That belief was very strong. Who can say what Henry IV absolutely in his heart of hearts believed? But it's reasonable to imagine that he did believe what was understood about God and the Christian faith, and that to fall foul of it might put him into eternal damnation. Let's imagine that was his psychology, and let's imagine that that was the psychology of the majority of people in the Middle Ages. So imagine looking on at that as a member of the general population, seeing the emperor go toe-to-toe with the Pope. You know, it's not just life and death. It's the very fate of eternal souls And perhaps, but you know, maybe if you were under the rulership of an emperor who's been excommunicated, does that mean that you're tainted too? You know, if your emperor, if your king is seen to be bad in the eyes of the church, is that infecting you like an airborne virus? Does that compromise your chances of getting to heaven as well? It's big stuff. A born fighter who fought all his life. Older, out of shape and heartbroken, the sharks are circling. His own son is at his throat. The King of France is making mischief. The Scots are prowling his northern border. And on the horizon is King Canute sailing with a great army. With war looming and money needed, it's tax, tax and tax again, as the most remarkable statistical document in the history of Europe is drawn up. The Doomsday Book. Next time in my love letter to the world. To help support this podcast and to get access to new and exclusive history and comment vodcasts every week, sign up to my Neil Oliver Patreon site. It'd be lovely to see you there. Check out the Instagram account. It's called Neil Oliver Love Letter. And there's my YouTube channel, which is simply called the Neil Oliver Channel. And to help build this podcast, please tell your friends about it. Get them listening and write a review to convince the online crowd to join us. For further reading about these moments in time, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the World in 100 Moments, and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the World is produced by Neil Oliver and Paul Ratcliffe for Catnip Inc. Music is composed by Milo McKinnon. Social media and YouTube producer is Oscar, CFR. Additional research is by Evie, Lucy and Archie and Teddy. Finance is by Catherine and Trudy. Post-production is by Althorpe Studios, and the graphics are by Paul Plowman. Thanks for listening. This has been a Catnip Inc. podcasts production.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.